Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum. I welcome our audience here in San Francisco and our online and radio audiences. And I'm pleased to introduce tonight Dr. Jonathan Kanik, who is a neuropsychologist. And he has a great talk, which I've heard before, on aging and the persistence of mind. And Jonathan.
Thank you very much, George. Thank you for inviting me, providing me this opportunity. There's a lot of people I would need to thank for being here. I did not build myself alone. I hope you find tonight's talk interesting. I hope you find it personally meaningful. I actually hope you end up leaving here somewhat different than you arrived. A lot of people have concern that aging involves mental decline, and that's inevitable. I've got a lot of good news for you. That's not inevitable. Not only is it not inevitable, but the mind actually persists. But there is a lot of anxiety around aging. I've seen the alternative and don't find that particularly attractive. Time waits for no one. Aging proceeds. But if you're really insistent on doing something about it, and I'm going to step down here to the next couple of comments. While you can't stop the process of aging, you can alter the experience of it. So damage this area in your basal forebrain, you will hold on to all of your memories. You will just lose the sequence with which they occurred. You won't know which came first, which came last. And in that way, you will lose the experience of chronology. Damage another area in your brain, in the hippocampus, and you will hold on to your memories up until that point. You just won't be able to make any new ones. And you will be puzzled when you look in the mirror and you see a face that is slightly grayer and older, and you will not fathom that. Damage another area in the temporal lobes, and you'll be able to make new memories. You'll just lose all the memories that you had up until that point. That's our Jane and John Doe's. I do not recommend these methods as a way to stop the experience of aging. There's been a revolution in our understanding about aging, a major paradigm shift. Not only how we look at aging, but how we look at those who are living longer. Long-held beliefs have gone out the window. They're now myths. It used to be thought, and many still do, unfortunately, believe that we're born with all the neurons that we'll ever have, and that starting after age 25 begins this inexorable decline of 1% neuronal loss each year. So by the time you're 75, you've lost 50% of your brain. No wonder everyone's so senile and so forth. That's gone out the window. We know that neuronal loss is not nearly as dramatic. It's more like 2% every decade, and it's more a kind of fatiguing and loss of elasticity of those brain cells. We also know that we could generate brain cells throughout the entire lifespan, the exciting field of neurogenesis. As I'm going to show you, there are other developments that happen to the brain as it is aging that compensates for that very process. And we all know these anomalies. People in their 70s, 80s, 90s, who are sharp as a tack. I had the pleasure several weeks ago of driving and listening to a fascinating lecture on foreign affairs. I thought I recognized the voice, and I thought it was this man. And I said, gee, that sounds like George Shultz. And sure enough, it was. He's going to be 92. He's not a freak of nature. He's an example of nature gone right. It is my privilege to train residents on how to identify cognitively compromised persons and patients because they're very poor at it. At the beginning of their rotation, I have them draw a line depicting the relationship between cognition and aging. And these are the most typical lines that get drawn. Wow. After you hit 25, it's like a downhill ski slope. I mean, it's like, wow. No chance whatsoever. I guess you decay and decline in varying degrees. That's what's most prominent. That's what most believe. That's what most physicians' view of aging is. I get these two on occasion. You're sort of going along and you fall off the shelf, or you just die. Least often is this one, and that's the one that's closest to the truth. Now, if you keep that line in mind that we just saw, you see that what these people think as normal aging is actually the slope of dementia. And so if you think that aging is a neurodegenerative process and that you lose your mind normally and your patient comes to you complaining of a memory complaint, what are you going to do? What do you expect? You're getting older. But that's not normal. That's dementia. I seek to identify these problems in this preclinical stage where there's separation from the actual process of aging so I could identify and intervene early in these conditions. Now, please take note, too, MCI. It means mild cognitive impairment. And this started off as actually a very helpful construct that described highly circumscribed problems of a cognitive or memory sort that were not dementia, were thought to be reversible, metabolic problems, things of that sort. And studies have found that now that this term gets used very widely, a lot of doctors are very uncomfortable with the D word. They think that their patients are going to freak out if they're told they have a dementia, that nothing can be done. I don't find that to be the case. I find that it is something that is actually quite approachable. But mild cognitive impairment gets declared very often. And if you are, in fact, 40 to 54, chances are that you're not going to experience dementia, but rather that you do have one of these reversible problems. But age further, and for those who are 55 to 65, the chance that that diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment, there's a 52% chance that it's actually dementia. And then if you're over 70, it's 100% that you actually have a dementia, but you get called mild cognitive impairment. How benign. Technology has helped us peer deeper into the brain and the mind and figure out many more things. On the left side here, I have a picture of this healthy 85-year-old's MRI brain scan. The MRI measures brain structure and anatomy. And if you were to compare her MRI scan with someone 20, 40, or 60 years younger, you all would notice distinct differences. You would see that there is a kind of atrophy that occurs in the brain, mostly in this frontal area, as we recall it. Now, it so happens that that atrophy accounts for the vast majority of age-related cognitive changes. That's the area of the brain that's involved in that phenomenon we call working memory. That's this ability to just mentally hold information there so it's available for further use. And as you start getting into your 50s, you go into the other room and you realize, why did I come in here? What was it I was looking for? Where did I put that thing that I was so important to me? We have more of that kind of experience. That accounts for some of the processing speed changes that also impact memory. But while that's occurring, select neuronal pathways are being more heavily reinforced so that cognition persists. This brain is more able to recruit other areas of the brain far better than a young person whose brain functioning is very bilateralized. We call it delateralization as you age, and you have more available brain to choose from and involve. Over here, we have a PET scan of this same individual. The PET scan measures brain activity, glucose metabolism in particular. Now, if you were to compare this with one 20, 40, or 60 years younger, you would not be able to tell a difference whatsoever, nor would a radiologist, if the brain is a healthy brain. So here at the outset of the talk, an important point that I hope you bring home. That yes, the brain is physical and it goes through physical changes, but it is also the organ of mental and cognitive activity, and cognitive activity does not change dramatically through throughout the lifespan. If you want to know about brain functioning and how that brain functions, well, then you're going to have to come into my world, the world of neuropsychology. And over the course of decades, it's been studied and figured out that there are certain abilities that relate to certain areas of the brain in a way that enables someone like me to do a variety of different tests and make inferences about the integrity of that brain. Now, I would not want to give you the false belief that the brain is some kind of map where there's cities and towns posted in some kind of fixed position. It's not. It's really more like this remarkable orchestra. And virtually every mental act is a symphony. Now, there's something else about this brain. It's not just in the skull. It's not just in the head. It's not just in the body of this individual. It's in the world. And the world is in the brain. And it has a profound influence. Language, education, toxic exposures, traumas, they have a profound influence on how a brain functions. Now, in general terms, we can talk about a left and right hemisphere. The left hemisphere is decidedly more verbally mediated. It's involved in the linear analysis and production of language, symbolic information, alphanumeric information. And so things like expressive speech, receptive speech, analytical abilities, numerical skills, those are all mediated by the left hemisphere. And it's actually kind of limited. Most of the information that we collect is actually visually based. The model of the left hemisphere of a verbal, it's like the sentence. And how many sentences can you read at the same time? How many conversations can you listen to at the same time? Only one, rather limited. By contrast, the right hemisphere is decidedly more visually mediated. There's multimodal sensory motor integration and input that's coming into the brain that provides us with a much more holistic picture of our environment. Artistic, gymnastic, musical abilities are associated with this. The right hemisphere processes information very quickly. As I say, though, the brain acts really together so that a song that can't be stated can be sung. And so I could see a patient in the hospital who maybe has strokes in her Broca's area, Wernicke's, she can't express herself, she can't comprehend speech. And the family's by devastated. And then I could come up to that person and say, can you tell me the words to Mary Had a Little Lamb? And the family's giving me dirty looks. And then I say, I'm going to sing. And if you'd like to sing along, please feel free to. And I start singing Mary Had a Little Lamb, and she joins in. You could imagine how much that means to a family who now has a way to make connection with their person who can't communicate. Let me give you a little experience of the hemispheres working together. Please read that paragraph. The remarkable thing is you can. If you don't have fluency in English for at least 10 years, this sort of looks like Swedish. I cannot believe that I could or like. But you can, because what's happening is your right hemisphere is rapidly processing this information. It's seeing the first and last letter, and it's accessing the left hemisphere, and it's knowing the word, and it goes on, and after by the third sentence, you're reading this thing as fluidly as if it was in plain English. Remarkable. The brain fills in. The brain always fills in. Any of you ever blink? I think so. Every time we blink, our occipital lobe shuts down. But we don't become blind. We don't have a flickering image of the world. We have this continuous streaming video that connects us with reality. It's always filling in. Ever see a face in the clouds? By the way, that face you see in the mirror, it's not yours. The brain already has made some adjustments. The brain has given it more symmetry than actually exists. It makes it a little bit more attractive than might be otherwise, which is why we never find a picture that does us justice. If your mirror is foggy, outline your face, your head. You will see it's about one-third the size of your real head. Well, let me now give you an experience of a collision. Please read this sentence. Now, as quickly as you can, tell me, how many F's are in this sentence? How many F's? Anyone? Four? Two? Four? That's pretty good. Five. There's six F's in this sentence. One, two, three, four, five, six. It's right in front of you and you can't see it. The right hemisphere is processing this so rapidly. I'm asking you to do a left hemisphere task, to analyze this in a letter by letter, word by word, and the right hemisphere will not have anything to do with that. It's processed it, it's moved on, I'm done. So you can't see something that's right in front of you. There are many myths of aging. Many of them relate to this most unfortunate notion that we disintegrate, that we deteriorate, that cognitive decline is normal. If there is significant cognitive changes going on, please seek help. It is not normal. We are so biased by ageism that we don't realize we have confused the process of aging with the cumulative effects of outright harmful, if not deleterious, habits. So yes, if you smoke, if you drink heavily, if you abuse drugs, if you have a poor diet, if you have a lot of stress, if you don't sleep well, if you don't have good social connections, if you don't treat your hypertension or your blood sugar, you're going to deteriorate and decline. But that's not aging. That's the cumulative effects of those conditions. And they can be managed in a way that promotes aging. When I was growing up, everybody had a relative who was living in the attic or somewhere else in their home who was senile. And if we lose 1% of our neurons every year after 25, by 75, that you lose 50% of your brain, it makes a lot of sense that everyone's going to become senile. But that's gone out the window. In fact, we don't use that word anymore, senility. We have a new word. It's called dementia. And there's nothing benign about it. If left unchecked and untreated, it will result in progressive disability and ultimately death. Mental changes do not occur in the same way that physical ones do. In fact, there are certain cognitive abilities that continue to develop and develop throughout the lifespan. So we could talk about two types of aging. Pathological aging and successful aging. In pathological aging, there's the onset of disease and illness, and we don't do anything about it. Not because we're cruel, but because we've come to accept that this is normal. And so someone who might have a folic acid deficiency that might even be treated with a bowl of lettuce or some supplements does not get treated, and it results in permanent brain damage or B12 deficiency. These deleterious effects go unidentified, untreated, with the result in calamity. This study took a large number of individuals at baseline and matched them on every variable, medical, demographic, socioeconomic, every variable possible, with the exception of one. There were some of those that had a very positive self-perception of aging, and those had a negative one. And they were simply followed over time. And after 22 years, there was a 7.5-year difference in the longevity of these two groups. Attitude, self-efficacy, has a profound influence on us. Now, I'm not trying to convey a picture of the power of positive thinking, but if you have positive expectations for yourself as you're aging and you're experiencing a problem, you're going to seek help in a way that somebody who lacks that is going to fall into the corner and await the natural unraveling of themselves. Attitudes have a profound influence on us, affect our sense of efficacy. If I was here giving you a lecture about how you're all going to decline and deteriorate, and I slapped a memory test in front of you, you would actually perform worse than if I give a talk talking about the virtues of aging. That potent is the effect. Sadly, most of these type of conditions get diagnosed and identified when people are overtly and grossly symptomatic. They're overtly and grossly symptomatic because there's been so much neuronal loss that the brain can't regulate itself anymore. And yes, we attempt to intervene at such times, and we could level off that process, but that's somebody who's not going to recover. That's not somebody who's going to be able to gain compensatory mechanisms, learn ways to accommodate for the changes that are going on. And that's the typical story and the typical picture. By contrast, in successful aging, we're not just interested in longevity, but adding meaning and fulfillment to people's lives. We look to intervene in these kind of conditions and processes in a meaningful way. We want to maximize function and capacity that people have. And we want to promote neurogenesis, the brain's capacity to generate new neurons throughout the entire lifespan. In this scenario, we look to intervene when there's been minimal loss, because it's going to show up on testing. It's not going to be grossly obvious. I don't want to wait till it's grossly obvious. People generally have a sense of themselves and if they are declining, if something is going on. I will illustrate that further as we proceed. If we intervene at this point with a much healthier brain, we see much more robust effects. That's somebody who could learn to accommodate, to compensate for their difficulty, who could engage in activities that's going to alter the trajectory of that decline. Ageism and nihilism, undoubtedly the two most biggest reasons for pathological aging. There's cultural bias, there's low expectations. The water is in the fish, and the fish is in the water. And the streams, byways, and highways of America is filled with anti-ageist bias. And it blinds us in ways that we don't even begin to realize. A lot of doctors, physicians, do believe that aging is a neurodegenerative process. I am shocked that the residents who are just coming out of medical school, somehow the revolution, they missed it. The new understanding and insights about aging have not penetrated down. So doctors will say, well, what do you expect? Could you imagine if your ophthalmologist said, you know what? Your eyesight's getting worse, but you're aging, so what do you expect? Or your internist said, I notice your blood pressure, your hypertension is worsening, but you know, you're getting older, so what do you expect? If they did not do something, that would be malpractice. And so it will increasingly be in this other area as we come to better understand it, have more interventions and ways to take care of these things. Now, apropos many people in this audience, there's a particular bias affecting the high functioning. The higher functioning you are, the less likely it is that you're going to ever be detected or identified as suffering one of these disorders until you are so dysregulated, so grossly symptomatic. A typical story. So I consult in the medical center quite often. Does this person have cognitive capacity? Can we discharge them? Are they all right? And not uncommon, I get asked by a hospitalist. That's a physician who practices just inside the hospital environment. And she says to me, can you take a look? I got this patient upstairs. Nice guy. In fact, he's a former San Francisco politician. You'll recognize him. He's fine, he's fine. Nursing staff's a little bit concerned. We're getting ready to discharge him. Just go up there and do your thing and assure them that everything is fine. So I'm in the patient's room when the hospitalist herself comes in. And I turn to the patient and I go, now, you remember me? Of course, of course. You remember the discussion that we were having? Yes, I do. Have you been thinking about those things I asked you to think about? I have. Could you please share with us some of your thoughts? At which point he starts expounding on his different thoughts. The hospitalist turns to me and says, just as I thought, everything is fine. You already know this guy. And I turn back to her and I say, this is the first time I've ever spoken to him. Everything he said has just been made up. He's confabulating, an advanced symptom of dementia. And furthermore, he's a former politician. He's accustomed to covering up his incompetence. Conversational abilities, social skills, these are at the forefront of all of our interactions. And so they obscure. As you'll see, our vocabulary remains intact even in the face of many dementias. So if that's your point of inference and understanding what's going on with this person, you will not see it. You will not experience it. And that hospitalist, by the way, as all physicians, are very bright people. I'm not trying to disparage anyone of this sort at all. But I'm talking about a kind of calamity that occurs regularly. There's a longer time before gross symptoms are evident, the higher functioning you are. And apropos, some people who might be in here too, that there's cognitive and cortical reserves. The more educated your brain is, the better it buffers and resists the effects of aging. The better you come out of a stroke, a brain injury, a brain surgery, a brain tumor. Having a more developed brain has many benefits to it. You have reserves. And so if you have dementia and an average person has dementia, the average person is going to show and express that far earlier than the higher functioning individual. Now, there might be some of these folks in this audience too. Mental giants. Those people who are functioning at the very superior range of the population. Their brains are as different from the rest of us as are those developmentally disabled, intellectually challenged persons' brains. And when they decline, it is unlike anything else, because they, islands of residual abilities remain. There's a Swiss cheese presentation. That's why family members get into big arguments, because if you land on the cheese, you will think all is okay, and Dad is just fine. Fall through one of those holes, you'll have a very different experience and thought about what's going on. This is an area where normal, so-called average results are neither normal or average for that person. A very superior person declining to the average range is like an average person falling to the severely impaired range. And to further illustrate that, normal distribution. So these things are equal. The change from here to here is no different than the change of an average person to the severely impaired range. It used to be thought that there were two types of Alzheimer's disease, one that affected high-functioning individuals and one that affected the average population, because it was noted that from the time of diagnosis here, these people were sort of going off and dying a whole lot sooner than these people who were trailing off. Well, neuroepidemiology exposed this picture. No, it's not that. It's that they've been declining all this time, and they get to that point, and they really fall through the hole. Dr. C, bright, bright man, great college education, wonderful medical school, top-notch residency. He goes into practice. He's a successful physician. But that's not enough for him. So he becomes involved in this new field called biotechnology, and he becomes the CEO of a biotechnology company. But he's done it right, and so he gets a chance to retire and enjoy life at around 65 or 66. The only problem is, within a year or two, his wife is noticing some problems, some changes. He doesn't notice that. He has no awareness of that whatsoever. He disputes it. And she then accompanies him to the doctor's office and talks about this. And one doctor talks to the other doctor and says, Dr. C, you really think this is going on? No. It's just that I'm around more. She's just seeing more of me and the things that she hadn't seen before. This is all normal. Another year or two passes, and now the children are coming in. And they're very concerned. Dad is different. Oh, come on. This is aging. This is normal. This is nothing major. Well, they refused to leave until they got some referral, and he was referred to me. Now, again, mind you, he doesn't think there's anything wrong. And after doing a comprehensive neuropsychological evaluation of him, these were the results. This genius is not in the genius level anymore. He's in the superior. He does retain a bunch of abilities. There are islands of residual ability. But there's also this. And he's now scoring down to the second percentile, the fifth percentile of the population. He's got a significant dementia. He's got one that's a rare one. Part of what is the first thing to go in it is this, the awareness of yourself. And if you have no awareness of a problem, there is no problem. And there's certainly no solution, because you can't fix a problem that doesn't even exist. I get to refer to a bunch of high-functioning people. Great privilege to see them, work with them. Part of what makes high-functioning people high-functioning is they got incredible brains. They pick up on things quickly. They also suffer a lot of frustration because they have to deal with the rest of us who don't. The most common diagnosis a high-functioning person has before coming to see me is that there's nothing wrong with you. Now, you don't have to be old to suffer this folly. Catherine Raymond was a young, hotshot New York Times journalist who decided to take a break from the rat race and the intense scene of Manhattan and the New York Times and moves out to California and starts a family with her husband. And after about 7 years, decides that it's time to get back to work, back to writing. Except she can't. She can't hold information in her head to get it down on paper. So she uses post-it notes. But she's buried in a sea of post-it notes, and she can't put them together and make sense of them. Well, she concludes that she must be suffering midlife memory loss, because all of her friends, she claims, has the same problem. She interests a book publisher in giving her a grant for a book that she's going to write where she's going to feature herself as the subject. And so she begins her journey at Harvard. She's writing a book. People want to get in that book, and they want to be listed very well. So she gets this major workup. She gets lots of attention. And they scan her. They do this, they do that. And they sit her down, and they tell her, "There's nothing wrong with you." Wow. She goes on to another medical center, another one. She goes on to a last one that has a sort of renowned memory and aging center. They do these major workups, and they all tell her the same thing. There's nothing wrong with you. At the last place, the memory and aging center, they say this is probably about aging. Catherine's 43 years old. So she's given up on her career and is bouncing around trying to figure out what she's going to do next. She's at a dinner party and relating her difficulty and the challenge that's on her plate. And there's someone who's heard me lecture and suggests to her that she gives me a call, which she does, and she tells me the story that I've just told you. And I said, "Well, Catherine, there's two things we know already. At age 43, there are no aging effects. And number two, there's something significantly wrong." "Well, Dr. Kanick, I got to tell you, you strike me as awfully arrogant. I've been to Harvard, this prominent place, that prominent. They worked me up for days. I met with chairmen who could bury you with their resumes." "No doubt true." "Well, Catherine, like you, I come from New York, so a certain degree of arrogance comes with the territory." "But you're telling me about something you did well. You are a New York Times journalist. That's not your average person. And now you can't write? By definition, something is wrong." So she agrees to come in for an evaluation. And I begin, as I do all evaluations, with an interview, collecting information about her background, events, any loss of consciousness, neurologic history, blows to the head. No. Okay. So we begin this testing activity, and we go on, and I'm noticing we've got very irregular results here. And I turned to her and I say, Catherine, I know I asked you about this during the interview, but is there any chance that you ever got hit here, right above your right ear? And she says, I can't believe you're saying that. Back home, I've got a metal helmet from my horseback riding days. It's dented in just that area. Well, Catherine, that's sort of like a head injury. I asked you about that and you said no. Might there be others? Absolutely not. Ah-ha-ha, fool me once. Before we meet again, I want you to speak to your family to see, might there be other examples? She comes back to that session, 20 major concussions in her lifetime. Knocked unconscious. We do the evaluation and it's like, Catherine, you're like the poster child for mild traumatic brain injury. By the way, we call mild traumatic brain injury the silent epidemic, because there's millions of Americans who've been brain injured and they don't know it. And sometimes that will emerge as that atrophy is occurring in your 50s to 60s or so, and they will think they have something new when no, it's an expression of something old. But Catherine, I have an idea. I think this is treatable. I have a colleague I'd like you to go see. I'd like you to try a trial of psychostimulants. We give that to people with ADD who also have altered brain functioning. And then I get this call. It's all back. It's all back. And with that, she wrote a wonderful New York Times article, and she wrote this book, and she's off to writing other books, and her world and career is resumed. So here's the problem. As much as 15% of the population over 71 may be significantly demented. As we increase in age, the prevalence increases. 80s, 90s, 35%. People over the age of 85 represent the fastest growing segment of our society, and us baby boomers are pushing that too, and we're hoping to be around for a while. The diagnosis of dementia, when it's been studied in terms of doctors' ability to diagnose this, typically find the diagnosis gets made 4 years after gross and severe symptoms are present. The game's over. One quarter to three quarters people with advanced dementia don't even carry a dementia diagnosis. You can't treat a problem that doesn't exist. Studies that have culled large numbers of cases so that there's 15,000 cases looking at how doctors do this with diagnosis and such, they find that false negatives and false positives are all over the place and that you're more likely to be misidentified than even misdiagnosed. And if you're depressed or hearing impaired, you're more likely to get a diagnosis of dementia. So it is my pleasure and privilege every three times a year or so, to announce to an individual and their family that I think we're going to cure this dementia. I want you to get your hearing checked out and get a hearing aid so that you can have sensory input. Because if you can't attend to things, you can't remember them. And then you think you have memory impairment. Well, no, it's you just never attended. You never got it in the first place. Information you don't get cannot be further processed. Less than 50% of people with mild to moderate dementia are never identified. Again, you can't have early intervention without early identification. Part of the problem has to do with the way that these things are viewed and identified. Some of you may be familiar with this test. It's called the Mini Mental Status Examination. It's like a 10-minute, 5-minute test. The most widely used test by neurologists and physicians to try to gauge mental functioning. Now, any test should have two properties. It should have sensitivity and be able to pick up on the disorder when it is present. It should have specificity. It should be able to distinguish between different disorders. This is how normals do. This is how people with mild cognitive impairment do. This is how people with frank Alzheimer's do. There's barely any separation. There's a 20% difference between the highest and lowest tier. There is no sensitivity. There is no specificity. I find this test, and I actually do a fair amount of lecturing and continuing ed with attorneys, and I tell them that for those of you that are involved in will contests, this test is really helpful because it does a great job of distinguishing two populations, the living and the dead. By comparison, here's one test, one of many, of neuropsychological functioning. Now, it's very sensitive to these problems because when people have Alzheimer's disease, they develop what we call an amnestic disorder. So they're read a story, and they're immediately asked to repeat it, which they do, and then a half hour later, they're asked, well, what was that story? Normals do really pretty good on that. You've got mild cognitive impairment, and you've got memory problems, you're not doing so good on that. You got Alzheimer's disease, you're saying, what story? Mr. B, high-functioning individual, was an attorney here in this town, became a judge. And he, too, felt that he was having problems. But his doctor assured him that this was just aging, that there was nothing significant to worry about. His wife came in on the next time, and the time after that, his children, and they said, we're not leaving until there's a game plan here. So they sent him to a neurologist, who evaluated him, interviewed him, sounds good to me. He's very articulate. He's scoring perfect on this test. Well, the family wasn't satisfied, so to humor them, he was referred to me. And these are the results of his testing. Now, this is a high-functioning person who should be scoring up here. This dotted line reflects his IQ. It's at the 50th percentile. Yes, it's in the average normal range, but that's not average or normal for him. Furthermore, he's got results also down to the second percentile. This is not the picture of normalcy. This is the picture of Alzheimer's disease, and we're not in the preclinical or first stage. We're in the second stage, and Mr. B generated perfect results on that test until 3 to 4 months before he was admitted to a locked dementia facility. When I'm lecturing in front of mental health audiences, I turn to them at some point, and I say, hey, you're mental health professionals. You tell me, is losing your mind traumatic? Is having someone you love turn into somebody completely different? Your spouse of 35, 40 years become a different person? Is that traumatic? Because generally nothing is done about this. And I, in my work, I seek to work with these individuals, with their families, prepare them, help them cope, understand what's going on, how to accommodate, how to intervene, all kinds of things, because this is traumatic stuff. And generally, nobody deals with it. So we return to this incredible organ. It sits at the crossroads of our existence. Anything and everything we've ever been, thought to be, might be, want to be, it's mediated by our brain. And yes, the brain is a physical organ, but it's also a more organ of mental and cognitive activity. And yes, there are changes as we age. There's atrophy, decreased cerebral volume and blood flow. There's speed changes, changes in working memory. But intelligence and cognition persist. Evolution would not have us such a cruel joke that we get to live this long only to decline? Well, there's those lines again. Those lines that the physicians drew depicting the normal relationship of cognition and aging across the lifespan. This is physical functions and vital functions. This is very real, as we all too sadly know, that our physical abilities are really not the same that they were when we were 25. So keep an eye on that slope, because that's the line that they draw. And undoubtedly, this is what got reified onto the brain, because the brain's a physical organ. It must go through the same things. We can divide cognitive functions into what we call crystallized, deeply learned, highly overlearned, deeply preserved and stored abilities, and more fluid abilities that are a little bit more susceptible to the influence of age and other kinds of conditions. Now keep that slope in mind, because here's the picture of some of our fluid abilities across the lifespan. Hey, that's a very different slope That's a very different set of... My Lord, there's some that actually get better as we age. And yes, our reaction time slows down. We processing speed makes it a little bit harder to make those new memories and to get them into long-term storage. But we're talking about being 80 years old and having 70 to 100% of the ability you had when you're 25. There is no organ, there's no physical function that rivals that. Here's your hard drive, crystallized intelligence, your verbal IQ. Look how solid that is across the lifespan. Our comprehension, our vocabulary literally increases. Our internal library, our hippocampus, has room for an unlimited amount of information. And that's part of what gives us a tremendous benefit over our poorer, younger counterparts. Stated otherwise, and here's both crystallized and fluid, crystallized abilities generally persist across the lifespan. There are some changes in fluid abilities, but we're not talking about gross, dramatic changes. If those are occurring, please seek attention. So, let's say you have a real vexing problem. It's going to change your life based on how you're going to decide this. Which of these two individuals are you going to turn to? This decrepit old brain here? Or this vital, vibrant brain here? Well, one of those people is Robert Hutchins, the former president of the University of Chicago, a big believer in adult learning. And he had a famous saying, most of the important things that a human being ought to know can't even be comprehended in youth. And it's true. The ancient Greeks knew this. They talked about the twilight years as the only time you could really perceive reality. I think our own experiences give us something more of that sense too. I mean, if young brains are so great, how come we're always having to apologize for what we did in our indiscreet, reckless, wild youth? There are benefits to aging. Wisdom, the combination of experience and knowledge that we could synthesize and integrate, and we can make inferences that a young person never could possibly be capable of. You already have to be of some age to have wisdom. As we develop, the brain recruits more areas. It's capable of making more sophisticated and nuanced decisions. The aged brain is not impulsive. It makes better judgments. Our memory develops greater search engines. We tease out better what's relevant, what's not. So a young vital brain is actually capable of hearing a dog whistle. Oh boy! Somehow, as we age, we lose that ability. It's extraneous. It's really not that relevant. We filter things, we discriminate things, we make better decisions. So, the percent increase in employment from 1977 to 2007 for people 65 and older, 75% increase. Women 65 and older, 147% increase. That's eclipsed by people age 75 and over who've seen 172% increase in their employment rates. Huh. The older you are, the less likely you are unemployed. Are these employers really hiring people who are dementing and declining and degenerating? I don't think so. I think they've realized that knowledge, wisdom, know-how is really valuable. And I think that we're increasingly learning and appreciating that fact. Neurogenesis, the brain's capacity to generate new brain cells, exciting area. How adaptive that at any age we could generate new brain cells that enables us to learn new information, to solve new problems, to change in a world that has changing demands. We know that there are certain regions that takes place particularly in the brain. The olfactory bulb, our sense of smell, actually is very much related to our abilities to learn. The hippocampus, well, that's our internal mental library. And so having more neurons and generating them is incredibly helpful to being able to learn new information. Now, this part of your hippocampus, there's an area called the amygdala. That processes emotional information. And emotion plays a key role in our memory. Our emotions are very old. We could read the ancient Greek literature. We could read the Old Testament, the New Testament. We could be touched and moved because we feel just like they felt. We think very differently. So our feelings are old, and they play a crucial role in determining what gets remembered and what gets sought, because the caudate nucleus is sort of like Grand Central Station. It's got these connections to all part of the brain and the most connections to the frontal lobe. It literally filters information, decides what's relevant. It decides what we're going to see and what we're not going to see. You all had a little taste of that. You couldn't see something that was right in front of you. The more emotionally charged an experience is, if it's traumatic, the brain's going to be looking to avoid that and identify when that circumstance comes up. If it's pleasurable, the brain's going to go for it. It likes pleasure. There are several activities you can do to promote neurogenesis. Every study finds cardiovascular exercise is central to generating new brain cells. Can't have it without that. If you take Alzheimer's disease patients who are in a facility, and you divide them in half and give half exercise, cardiovascular exercise, there will be discrete differences in the volume of their hippocampus after a while. They will start to have better memory than those that did not have exercise. Sleep, crucial. Now, there are exceptions to all rules. There are some people who claim to get by on 3-4 hours of sleep. But if you're generally sleeping 4 to 6 hours, we call that sleep restriction. You will become cognitively symptomatic. Your memory will take a whacking. And sleep preserves those new brain cells generated by cardiovascular exercise. You're sleeping less than 4 hours, sleep deprivation, you're going to lose your mind. And you're going to be increased risk for stroke, all kinds of medical illnesses. Sleep is crucial. New learning, new experiences, new associations, new connections, keeping the brain active and vital is crucial. Nutrition, managing stress. Stress has an interesting U-shaped curve. Too little, too much, and we get in trouble. We need a certain amount of stress for optimal learning and functioning. Some additional risk factors and things you could modify to improve your cognition, to buffer against cognitive aging, crucial. The notion, old notion of retirement, of you're sitting in a rocking chair on a porch somewhere, that's what I wish for my enemies, because I know they will decline and deteriorate. Isolation, depression, alienation, fear, trembling, and the sickness unto death. That's part of the existential challenge we face throughout our life, perhaps more so as we're older and our trees becomes a little bit less with leaves and becomes more defoliated. We lose contacts. People die. We could be stuck in our ways and get into a rut and not venture out and instead retreat to our corners and our familiar worlds and decline. This is not what to be. By contrast, we can be like this, like the dolphins here. We don't find ourselves in isolation. We locate ourselves in activity. We locate ourselves in each other, in the combined and collective experiences we have. We crave and need social interaction. Now, if there were children here under the age of 12, all they would see is the 9 dolphins that are pictured there. But I'm suspecting you people are seeing something else, because you've had experiences that the 12-year-old hasn't. And like I mentioned before, your brain will steer you to what you can see and what you can't see. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Doctor. And
I'd like to remind our audiences that they're listening to Dr. Jonathan Kanick at the Commonwealth Club of California, speaking on aging and the persistence of mind. And now we have a little bit of time for questions for those of you who can remember the questions they wanted to ask.
And I'll be happy to stay a little later.
And after the official time is over, then Jonathan will stay and answer more questions. So who would like to ask the first question?
So with a patient who has fairly severe Alzheimer's and was kind of lost speech or hard to communicate to, if you played favorite music from youth, would that get a response?
Yes.
That be positive?
Nothing awakes and activates the brain like music. I'm working on some writings. I work with these cases. And the last chapter of the book and what I see, even in such persons as was described who are compromised, grossly compromised, love. They remain available for love. Love becomes more possible. It's a deep emotion. Deep emotions exist. I sadly have been told many times by patients that Alzheimer's that hit Dad, that stroke that hit Dad, best thing that ever happened to him. That prickly guy who you never could get close to, all of a sudden, he became emotionally available. So yes, music plays an important role. Having music playing around people who are so compromised can be very comforting to them. Deep emotions, poignant deep emotions, continue to be expressed. And it's part of when I'm working with a couple where one is disintegrating like this, that ends up being sort of the final pathway. And it's very touching. Ma'am?
Two questions about family involvement. You talked about families and patients themselves who came in and wanted to get the testing. What do you do with a family who can't get the Alzheimer's or the person who appears to have dementia to come in for any kind of evaluation? Is there a compelling argument or story that you tell about that? And also, how do you deal with the family where you have adult siblings and one or two sees how bad it is, but the others are in denial?
Well, the second question is a little bit easier because the testing will sort of bring that together and I will present it. And as I referred to before, oftentimes what's going on in that situation is that there's a piece of Swiss cheese and somebody's landing on the cheese and somebody's falling through the hole and they're having disagreements. So I serve to help resolve some of those. Sometimes the mountain has to go to Muhammad. And I will sometimes go into people's houses and visit them there to evaluate them or try to hook them with a notion that we might find something that will improve them and make them better. But there are some limits too. Sir, I'm sorry. Ma'am?
I think we have a profound social situation to be addressed, and I would like you to try to do it. There are processes for putting people in certain jobs based on their abilities at a given time. And over time, for one reason or another, they may lose certain faculties and get more faculties. And how do we keep the discrimination process, I mean, just in a good sense, of the people that will lead our country, our nation, our world, our businesses, so that we get the maximum capabilities on a continuing basis when people change individually and we can't use the ordinary inception of employment to screen them out?
Great question. It sounds like one that could be a whole lecture. I think it's crucial importance that people remain active and kept active. And learning different skill sets has tremendous virtue in terms of keeping your brain developed and healthy. So having varying activities or occupations has some real benefit to that. There's been no shortage of people 85 years old who've come to me and been evaluated and they're retired and you know what? It's time to go back to work and I advocate that. Somebody mentioned about music, learning a new musical instrument, keeping the brain active and balanced. Very, very important. I'm sure that does not by any means satisfy the wonderful question you asked. Sir.
Is there any correlation between sexual vitality and dementia? I'm looking for a barometer here.
I'm not that familiar with it, that topic, to say. I can tell you that brain health, cardiovascular exercise, a lot of these things that are promote do also promote good sexuality, too. And good sex is very healthy for the brain. But we see a divide in those that lose regulation of their brain. There are those that sort of implode and become sort of like people who've had a frontal lobotomy with very little, very inert. They can't execute. They can't initiate. The spontaneity is gone. And then we also see people who become disinhibited. And they're jumping on people on the street and things like that. I don't know if that exactly relates to their improved sexuality. I think it reflects that the lid has been lost and that their ability to control. And people can get into a lot of trouble, in fact, with these kind of things.
Thank you.
You're very welcome, sir. Ma'am? Another great question. So people do, we get disabled sometimes, we get injured, etc. We're in a wheelchair, we're bound that way. I do think that there is always physical activity. There's always a way. I'm a firm believer that I don't care how bad the situation is, there's always a way to make it better. But there's other kinds of physical activities to pursue, even with limitations. And there's other forms of stimulation and brain activation as well. And we do the best we can in terms of those things. In terms of a more physiological explanation, if that is what you're asking, I don't possess the expertise to give you a good answer to that. Sir?
These days there's a lot of computer exercises and so forth, brain gymnastics and whatever. Is that a bunch of hoax or is that some usefulness?
The research is mixed. What we see is that people get better at those brain exercises and those computer programs. How much actually generalizes is uncertain. To some degree, one thing that can generalize, that can be very helpful about that, is reaction time. And so they have found with older drivers who then go through these kind of training that their reaction times and reflexes are a little bit sharper than otherwise. But I'm a big believer in the three-dimensional world. I'm a dolphin. I like interacting. I like locating myself in activities with others. I believe heavily in the three-dimensional world, social stimulation, incredibly important, new connections, new associations. I think that there's a lot of ways to go there, but product sells.
Now it's time we have one more question, Mary.
What causes a person to have a problem with visualization? This is not only a person that's older. If they have a guided imagery session, they can't do it. Mm-hmm. What causes that?
Well, vision is of incredible importance to our survival and existence. That's why our occipital lobes are right back here where they're very well protected. 70% of the information and knowledge we have is visually based. We high-functioning people live in the verbal world and we like to believe a lot in the virtues of knowledge and matters verbal, but the visual world is really where it's at. Now, there's many places and ways for something to go wrong with your eyeballs, your eyesight. If you don't have sensory input, just like hearing input, you're not going to get it. But it's also possible to have unusual visual problems that have to do with the relays between the eyeballs and the brain back here. So sometimes people have what we call visual field cuts that they're not even aware of. And I might ask someone to draw a picture of a clock and they might draw it here and put in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and they think that they've drawn a complete clock. They're unaware. They have what we call neglect. And if I ask them to draw the hands 10 so that they show 10 minutes after 11, they'll draw an arrow with a 10, and then after that, 11, 10 minutes after 11. There are those who also suffer what we call visual neglect syndromes, where their vision is okay, but they're not able to interpret, and it's usually the left upper part of their visual field that they don't process or see. And then there are people who develop what we call cortical blindness, Anton's syndrome, where they're blind and they don't know it, they don't recognize it. In fact, they believe that they're seeing just perfectly well, and they will get up out of a wheelchair and they'll start walking. Where are you going? I'm going home. Wow. So there are many places, many relays. Vision is of incredible importance, so that it's complex. There's a lot of places where it can potentially go wrong. But it's oftentimes either back here or those eyeballs, the relays in between.
Jonathan, time is up. I had one last comment about the Swiss cheese, you know, for different siblings seeing different things, the question earlier. But my father went through the same experience when he was about 75. It was a couple months after he had had bypass surgery. My brother was caught in the Tiananmen Square crisis in China, and that kind of undid him, unsettled him. And a couple of my younger siblings were asking him questions, trying to get an answer, trying to get their father back the way he was before. And I took him for a walk and asked him what he was thinking about, what he was dreaming, and he just couldn't say everything that he wanted to say about that. And then he said, oh, I can actually think. Not, I thought that was an important distinction. I don't know if you've run into that too, but if you do a leading question rather than a demand for an answer, mm-hmm. that you can get a reaction, I guess, at least in the mild cognitive impairment state.
Yeah, and it's not even mild cognitive impairment. There's something significant going on. But yes, there's roads, there's alternate roads to Rome. Yes, you've hit upon exactly the thing I'm talking about in terms of with your father.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. You can stay for more questions, but thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you so much.
And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 110th year of enlightened discussion. The doctor is in.